Welcome to the podcast that is all about self-employment. We'll be sharing expertise on getting started, getting noticed, and getting it right, as well as dealing with getting it wrong. Your host, Julia Kermode, will help you get ahead so you get the success you deserve.
Welcome to today's episode. I'm really pleased to be joined by Luina Farrell, and we are going to talk about gig economy workers and the recent Supreme Court decision in relation to Uber. Now, Luina is a solicitor, and she was previously head of legal services at a leading professional body in the recruitment sector. And in that role, she advised recruitment agencies on employment law, commercial matters, matters specific to recruitment, such as agency worker regulations, IR35, which is a tax change coming up. And she did a lot of the lead work on IR35 there. And we've covered IR35 in other podcasts, and recently left that role and is now in the process of setting up herself as an independent consultant. So really warm welcome, Luina. We're really pleased to have you with us.
Well, thank you very much, Julia, for asking me to do it.
No, it's brilliant, because actually this story is so timely, and the press that I'm seeing around it, it's not always 100% clear exactly what has happened, what's been decided. And I think it's really important for our listeners. So what did the Supreme Court decide last week?
Well, yes, you're right. There has been quite a lot of press in the last week on this. And I know some of us have been waiting quite a while for this decision. So dare I say, we were quite excited on Friday when the decision came out. And there's been a flurry of activity over the weekend and the last few days, with various people digesting the decision, doing blogs, etc. And it is being marketed as a landmark decision. But basically, Julia, this whole matter started off back in 2015 when some Uber drivers brought a case against Uber. They claimed to be workers for the purposes of national minimum wages, the working time regulations, and in the case of one driver, that he was a whistleblower entitled to protection under the Employment Rights Act 1996. So it got to the Employment Tribunal, and in 2017, the Tribunal, and I might sometimes say ET, and if I say ET, that's the abbreviation for the Employment Tribunal, they found that those drivers were indeed workers. And we will come on in a moment to talk about why this is really important. And at the time, the Employment Tribunal also dismissed as faintly ridiculous the idea that Uber was a mosaic of 30,000 small businesses linked by a common platform. And it said that drivers do not and cannot negotiate with passengers, and they are offered and accept trips later on Uber's terms. And that's quite an important point, and I will come back to that later, this whole thing about being an independent business, etc.
I was just going to say, it's funny, I remember those exact words from that case, faintly ridiculous. that has stuck with me for some reason. It's quite strong, actually, but I didn't mean to interrupt you. Go on.
No, you're okay. I could talk forever. So the 2017 decision by the Employment Tribunal was then ultimately upheld by the Employment Appeals Tribunal, because Uber had appealed it. They lost at the Employment Appeals Tribunal, and they then appealed to the Court of Appeal, where again they lost. And so the fourth hearing then was in the Supreme Court, and that was back in July 2020. And now the Supreme Court has indeed confirmed the previous decisions that, yes, those claimant drivers were indeed workers. So Uber have lost each step of the way. Now, the judgment directly affects a small number of claimants. So when you get a judgment like this, you see one or two names, and then you see and other. Mm-hmm. So there are only a small number of actual claimants. But what happens now is, now that we have the Supreme Court decision that says, yes, they are indeed workers, it now goes back to the Employment Tribunal so that it can assess the compensation that they're due under the National Minimum Wage Act and the Working Time Regulations. Now, what's interesting, of course, is, as I said, there are only a small number of claimants here, but we know that Uber is massive. And I think somebody could prove me wrong here, but I read certainly back in 2016 when the drivers took the claim, Uber has something like 40,000 drivers in the UK. Now, it's quite possible they have many more than that now in the intervening
years.
But Uber has said that it recognises the court judgment only in respect of those actually named in the claim. So it's not accepting right. that the applies across the board to all workers. Now, I think that's disingenuous. There may have been tweaks to the terms that the drivers have been on, but I understand that in the main, the working practices remain the same, again, unless somebody wants to contradict me later. So that's quite interesting. Now, you know, if people think that there are thousands of workers who can now piggyback on this, that's quite interesting, because potentially they could. And indeed, there may be some class actions. But Uber at the moment saying that, no, it only applies to those individuals who were named.
Okay.
And of course, then if there are other platforms, again, it doesn't automatically apply to individuals working through other platforms, because even the court recognised this decision that different platforms do operate in different ways.
And I did want to ask you whether it did affect people across the board, because some of the headlines I've seen did seem to suggest that. And I thought, hang on a minute, I don't think that's correct. So you've already answered my first question. But I do agree with you. It is a bit disingenuous if they're using the same sort of contracts and practices. Before we kind of go into the detail of kind of the contracts and their practices and all of that stuff, why is employment status important?
Okay, so we've actually had employment status cases going through the courts for many, many years. But they're important because your status will determine the rights that you have as an individual and also the obligations that any prospective employer has towards you. So your status, whether you're an employee, a worker or self-employed, determines what rights you have under the law. And so, for example, in employment law, there are three statuses. So if you were to draw a line, one end of the spectrum, you have the genuinely self-employed. And those are people who are really running their own businesses. Yeah, but they have few protections in law. It's deemed that they don't need them. You know, they've decided that they're running their own businesses. They're not vulnerable. Mm-hmm. They know what they're doing. They've got multiple clients, etc. So they don't need the same level of protection in the law. At the other end of the spectrum, then, we have employees. And those and employees have the widest range of protections under employment law. So, for example, they have the right to the national minimum wage or living wage. They have protection under the working time regulations. And there, I mean, rest periods and breaks, but also paid holiday. They're also entitled to sick pay, various parental rights, pensions, auto enrollment. And then employees also have some rights which are reserved just to them. So here I'm thinking about a right to claim unfair dismissal, a right to a redundancy payment where they've got 2 years service and have then been made redundant, and also a right to be TUPE'd. And that, by that, I mean to be transferred from one employer to another in certain circumstances. So employees have quite a wide range of protection. But then in employment law, we also have this intermediate category, a third category, and they are workers. And they're somewhere along this spectrum between employed and self-employed. Now, increasingly, they have many of the same protections as employees. So they have the right to national minimum wage, working paid holiday, rest breaks, etc. But they don't have the right, for example, to claim redundancy. You have to demonstrate that you're actually an employee before you can be made redundant. Nor do they have the right to claim unfair dismissal or to be TUPE'd. But certainly they do have a wide range of rights. So that's why your status, whether you're self-employed, employed or a worker, is it's really key to understand what you may be entitled to from the putative employer. Now, we're not going to talk about tax much at all today, if we can avoid it. But we
hooray!
I know there's another podcast on IR35, but in tax law, there are only two statuses, self-employed and employed. But for employment law, there is this third category. And just one last point on this. Of course, as the gig economy grows, and certainly, you know, with the pandemic, you know, and more people are losing work, more people are now trying to find to make a living in various ways.
Yeah.
And they are turning to various platforms and organizations such as Uber, etc. So actually, it is really essential that individuals know what their status is, what rights they have, irrespective of how these gig economy businesses try to categorize them.
Yes, and I think that's an important point, actually, is that that it doesn't matter, like in Uber's case, and we'll probably go into it, but I think Uber deliberately wanted to engage those, what their workers as self-employed, signed them up and engaged with them on that basis. Those workers, some of them will have been quite happy to have been self-employed and whatever, and I think to some extent both parties set out to have it as a self-employed relationship, but however the courts have looked at it, and in practice the courts have decided that for those people that brought this case around about, that they are actually workers. So it's quite interesting that it doesn't matter what the intention is, it's the practical reality that's important. And I know we'll go on to a little bit around that. So could you give us a bit more detail about what the Supreme Court decided and how they kind of got to that decision?
Yes, of course. So there was a two-day hearing back in July 2020. I believe it was all done remotely because, of course, we were right in the thick of the pandemic at that point in time. And there were seven judges at the time, but the court then published its decision Friday, the 19th of February, 2021. It was a unanimous decision, but only by six judges, because actually one had taken ill he was going to be out for some time, and it was decided they couldn't go ahead. But it was still a unanimous decision by six judges.
Okay.
Now, the court decided that the drivers were what we call in employment terms limby workers. And I'll just explain that briefly. And a limby worker is somebody who works under a contract, which is either expressed, and by that we mean written, or implied, which could be by custom, how they operate. It could be written or oral, under which he undertakes to perform services personally for someone who is not a client of a business run by that individual. Now, we're not going to have time to break that down entirely, but points like performing services personally for someone who is declined, they're really quite key, but we're not going to have lots of time to talk about those today. But the court, in its judgment, gave five key reasons why it held, why it considered that these individuals were workers. And it really did look at the terms of business, but also particularly the working practices of Uber it managed and controlled the drivers. But in essence, here are the five points. Uber fixed the rate for each journey. It also fixed its own service fee. And therefore, it fixed really the amount that the drivers could earn. They had no autonomy over the fare that they would could charge. Although they could agree to lower the charge, and I must admit, no driver I've ever had has lowered the charge. They could so there was a cap on the fare that could be charged. And Uber could also decide at its own discretion if ever it needed to refund a fare, either in whole or in part. So ultimately, drivers actually had no control whatsoever over the fares. They were completely set by Uber. The next point was that Uber dictated the terms on which the drivers provided their services, both to Uber, but also the terms agreed with passengers. So again, the drivers had no control over the terms on which they were engaged. And that was quite important as well. Ultimately, you know, I did look at the point about, you know, they had no negotiating power. The court did recognise that drivers could choose when and where to work, albeit because they had to be licensed. There were restrictions in terms of the geographical area in which they could work. They could only work in the area for which they were specifically licensed. But otherwise, once they were logged on to the Uber app, then their choice about whether to accept or reject a request for a journey was quite restricted. So it was absolutely up to a driver whether he or she wanted to log on in the first place. So there's no obligation to log on and be available. But when they do log on and made themselves available, then there were restrictions about how many requests for trips that they could actually turn down. And so it was held that this was obviously quite significant control that Uber had over the drivers. But also there was quite a bit of discussion around the ratings. So if you've ever taken an Uber, you'll know that you are asked whether you want to rate the driver, and indeed they get to rate you as well. But These ratings are used really to control the performance of the driver, as although Uber will also say it's to maintain standards, which I understand. So Uber has quite a lot of control over the drivers in terms of how many trips they are allowed to reject before they're logged off the app, but also then in terms of the ratings. And what's quite interesting is certainly at this time, you know, drivers don't understand how those ratings necessarily are calculated, or at least what the algorithm is. The fourth point was around the delivery of the services, which I have already discussed briefly. But in particular here, it was around the technology that was used. I mean, Uber have obviously invested significantly in the technology, and they've created this app, which both drivers and passengers can use. But the drivers can obviously only use the Uber app when they're working for Uber. Quite a lot of control there. And also, this was a new one on me, that actually Uber quite tightly controlled the types of cars that the drivers could use, even so far as the colour and the age. Apparently, I'm going to check this the next time I take an Uber. They can only be black or silver. No, I never observed that, but I will have a look. And
now you say that, I think I've only ever had a black Uber. Not that I'm a big Uber user, but interesting.
Well, I use one for research purposes, and I'll see if I get to later. But the final point, Julia, around why the court decided they were workers was really around the restrictions that Uber placed in terms of the drivers connecting with passengers. So Uber took the request from the passengers, put that out to the nearest driver. The driver did get to choose whether to accept or reject, subject to the provisions I said earlier, but didn't give any details. So the passengers and the drivers were not able to communicate with each other otherwise. And so the driver only had really the minimum necessary to perform the particular trip. So having gone through all that at length, if I was to sum that up, and I'm going to paraphrase now from the judgment, Julia, the court said that the transportation service performed by drivers and offered to passengers through the Uber app is very tightly defined and controlled by Uber. It is designed and organized in such a way as to provide a standardized service to passengers in which drivers are perceived as substantially interchangeable, and from which Uber, rather than the individual drivers, obtains the benefit of customer loyalty and goodwill.
Yeah, now, that's such a good point, isn't it? Because if they were genuinely self-employed, they would be making their decisions themselves, setting the rates themselves, and then they, as individual self-employed taxi drivers, would have the benefit of that reputation, etc. And I hadn't, until you just said it then, I hadn't ever picked up on that point. I think that is a really, really important part of it, because if you are genuinely self-employed, it's your business and you have all the benefits, whereas it doesn't look like that was the case here.
That's absolutely right. I mean, we've spoken for years about status, haven't we, and talked about whether people are genuinely running their own business or not. But Julia, having gone through those five points and then paraphrased there, I don't know if you noted, I haven't mentioned anything about personal service. Because as I said at the beginning, individuals have to be licensed in order to be able to drive as a taxi driver. And so this is one instance where the court didn't actually look at personal service, and personal service is really important. And certainly it was a key issue in another Supreme Court decision a couple of years ago in Pimlico Plumbers. But because here the drivers have to be licensed, they can substitute. There were enough other pointers towards them being workers that the court didn't need to look at them, look at personal service.
Okay. And for our audience, personal service is often an indication of being more akin to a worker and an employee than someone who's genuinely self-employed.
So that's the key thing. In a nutshell, the drivers really had very little control over how they operated. You know, they were offered journeys. If they took them, then there were quite a lot of restrictions around them. They couldn't increase the fares, etc. And indeed, the only way that a driver could increase their earnings would be simply to work for longer hours and do more journeys.
Yeah. Okay. And then what did they say about working time? So, I mean, there is a certain amount of flexibility, as we've said, as to the drivers when they want to log in to the app. So what did they kind of talk about in relation to working time?
Now, this is a really interesting point here. So you're absolutely right. The drivers don't have to be logged on all the time, you know, so it's very mm-hmm. clear to everybody that they're not working when they're not logged on. The question then yeah. is, are they working from the point at which they log on until they log off? Or are they actually only working during the time that they're driving somebody from A to B? Because they could mm-hmm. be hanging around for quite some time as well. So a really important point here. For anybody who actually wants to read the judgment, it is 43 pages long, but it's actually, dare I say it, a relatively straightforward judgment to read. But specifically at paragraph 129, the Supreme Court said that the Employment Tribunal was justified in finding that all time spent by a driver working under a workers' contract with Uber London, including time spent on duty, and by that it means logged on to the Uber app, to accept a trip request is working time within the meaning of the Working Time Directive and the Working Time Regulations. So it's clear there that from the point at which they log on until the point at which they log off is working time and not just the time that they spend driving. And that raises a really interesting question. I mean, one, apart from the fact that, of course, they could be hanging around for some time and Uber clearly wouldn't want to pay them for the time that it's not earning from passengers either. But back in 2015, when the drivers first took the case, I understand that really Uber was the only platform around providing this. But now, jump forward 6 years, there are a number of other platforms providing similar services. And so there is scope for some of these drivers to be logged on to multiple apps at the same time.
Of course, now,
it's not inconceivable in employment law that you can have more than one employer at the same time. But I suppose that, you know, the question is, can you be working for more than one employer at the same time? Now, this isn't something that they wanted to look at. So actually, that question hasn't been answered for us here.
That is really interesting. So if say I employ someone and they're working for my business, I certainly don't want them working for me at exactly the same time. So I might be paying them an hourly rate. I don't want them doing work for someone else exactly the same time. And of course, these Uber drivers might also be doing deliveries or parcel deliveries or all sorts of different things. So yeah, this is actually very interesting.
It is, but we don't have the solution today, I'm afraid.
No.
All I would say is that the in terms of, you know, how the individuals and the putative employers themselves might get around it, previously the Court of Justice of the European Union held that it wasn't the responsibility of an employee to find a solution to a given problem. And certainly when I was listening to a webinar earlier this week about this case, I did hear someone say, well, Uber, with all of the technology that they have to hand, it must be within their power to be able to work out when somebody actually is working and when they're not working, you know, or when they're working for, you know, potentially another app or something. So unfortunately, we don't have a decision on this. This is one that is going to have to come out in future cases, but it is a really interesting point.
Just thinking about what we're saying, it could lead to the Ubers of the world spying on their workforce to make sure that they are genuinely working for them when they should be. And that's a whole other question that is not really one to get into now. But since we've been working from home during lockdown, there has been a lot more discussion about employers spying on their workforce. The privacy point aside, what did the court say about the written agreements versus the law? So we touched on that a little bit before, but yeah, tell us what were the court's view?
Okay, so ordinarily when there's this dispute between parties, whether that's commercial organisations or indeed an employer or a worker, the starting point is always, what are the terms of engagement or the terms of business? Mm. And so that's usually where the parties and then ultimately the any tribunal or court will look at. And so in terms then of, you know, somebody claiming worker or employment rights, the question then would be, what do the terms between the organization and the individual, what do they say about this individual and how do they categorize this individual? So that's the starting point. But if we go back 10 years now, we go back to 2011 in what was then the Auto Cleanse case. And that was about car balloters. You know, the guys that you see in the supermarkets. So when you go to the supermarket, you drop your car and they want to wash your car. Every time I do that, I think of Auto Cleanse. It's really an occupational hazard. Everywhere I go, I see employment status. But all jesting aside, back in 2011, the Supreme Court, again, this Auto Cleanse decision was a Supreme Court decision. And the Supreme Court held that the Employment Tribunal was indeed entitled to hold that the contractual terms did not reflect the true agreement between the parties. So, yes, you might start by looking at the terms, but in fact, if the reality is something different, the court, the tribunal is entitled to disregard the terms and look at the reality of the situation. So that was 2011. And certainly, you know, we've had various judgments since then, which also refer to that decision and that point.
Mm.
Now, in this decision, in the Uber decision, the Supreme Court has built on that, but they've actually gone even further. And they've said that the tribunals should actually start by asking whether the individuals are workers within the meaning of the legislation, irrespective of what has been contractually agreed. And that means then that the tribunals should look at the particular provision and interpret its language so far as possible in a way that best gives effect to that purpose. So here we're talking, Julia, about what is the general purpose of the legislation under which the drivers were claiming. And if the general purpose is to protect vulnerable workers from being paid too little for the work they do, required to work excessive hours or subjected to other forms of unfair treatment, such as being victimized for whistleblowing. So it's looking really at if I, as an individual, am I the sort of person, are my working arrangements the sort of arrangements that are intended to be looked at by the legislation, protected by the legislation, irrespective of whatever agreement I might have with an organization. And I think that's really quite significant.
Yeah, that's massive. And, you know, as we kind of said, it means that that it's not just for the business to make that decision.
That's absolutely right. I mean, I've seen lots of contracts over the years where the contracts say that the individual is self-employed and they'll indemnify the business, you know, if they seek to make any sort of worker employment claims, etc. But yes, it simply means that, you know, a business cannot just determine unilaterally that an individual is self-employed if, in fact, the working reality is something quite different, and the legislation has been written to protect those workers, and that would then be the starting point. You know, are they actually the sort of people who are intended to be protected by the legislation rather than what the contract says? And for example, it did then, you know, it did draw a distinction between, you know, those individuals and indeed contractors who have what they called a sufficiently arm's length and independent position to be treated as being able to look after themselves in the relevant respects. So, Julia, there I'm talking about the genuinely self-employed we mentioned earlier on.
Yeah. It all of this stuff is quite important because you could have a scenario where a firm is deliberately exploiting people and having them as self-employed contracts and maybe not paying them even the minimum wage or whatever because they're not entitled to it if they are self-employed. And so it could be quite an exploitative arrangement. But actually, what we're saying is that in this case, they looked at the reality of the situation, not just what was agreed in writing.
Yes, absolutely. So they did spend time, obviously, looking at the contracts and identifying which parties were party to the contracts. But they spent significant time, if you go back to the five reasons I gave, really looking at the reality. Mm. And just one final quite important point here, Julia, is that the court also noted that it's not possible for individuals to contract or opt out of their statutory rights, except in very limited circumstances. And so even if you have a written term or a clause in an agreement which tries to exclude or limit those statutory protections that the individual is entitled to, in fact, those provisions or clauses would then be disregarded, and so they wouldn't have any effect anyway. And again, I have seen lots of contracts where there are attempts to opt out, and it's like, well, actually, that just doesn't, you know, that's just not enforceable. It just can't apply because...
Wow. So what's going to be next for Uber then? Because we know we said earlier that this judgment is applicable to a small number of their workers, not everybody. So what do you think they'll be doing next?
So this is really interesting. And again, this is why I was doing my research with the driver the other day. I wanted to find out what had Uber sent to him. And it would seem that Uber... And I am paraphrasing here. It was a little unclear, but it seems that Uber have asked the drivers for their opinion on the judgment.
Oh.
Now, he swayed either way what he thought about it. But he did go into great detail about working for various different companies and how they treat them, etc. I don't know. Again, maybe a listener knows more than me. But at the time when I spoke to this particular Uber driver, he didn't say that they had received an email telling them the judgment didn't apply to them. They received an email asking them for their view. But anyway, I haven't seen that email. But anyway, so what does this actually mean for Uber in practical terms? Well, the first thing is that the employment tribunal, which looked at this back in, between 2016 and 17, must now determine the level of compensation due to the driver. So if you recall, they were looking for national minimum wage and also paid holiday. So the employment tribunal now has to work out what the compensation is to those named drivers. But as I also said, you know, there is an argument. It applies across the board to all the drivers, but that's an argument that Uber have flatly rejected to date. So it will be interesting to see if at any point, if there's an attempt by groups of drivers through class actions, for example, if they can't negotiate with Uber, we end up with class actions to get Uber to apply the judgment. Certainly, I know those drivers wouldn't want the claims to take 6 years as well. So that's the first thing. We're looking at, you know, the backdated claims for minimum wage and for paid holiday. But then there are also some knock-on costs, which the court hasn't looked at, but I'm just picking up on it because they're workers. And as a worker, you are therefore entitled to other things. So there might be sick pay claims, for example, but also workers are entitled to be automatically enrolled for pension, subject to meeting certain relevant criteria. Now, the drivers didn't claim that, but, you know, it's a possible knock-on effect. Plus, obviously, employers have to pay employers' national insurance, which is quite a significant cost of 13.8%. And then there's also the apprenticeship levy, which employers have to pay on payroll. And only, you know, a small number of employers under a certain threshold are exempt from that. So notwithstanding the actual claims made by the drivers, there are quite a lot of knock-on costs. Of course, HMRC could also pursue Uber for any unpaid national minimum wage on behalf of other drivers.
Yes.
And this is a really interesting one, but I don't want to go into great detail. They could potentially also pursue them for VAT. And that's because the court rejected Uber's argument that it was acting as the driver's agent, because where an employer supplies their own worker, they have to charge VAT. And of course, VAT is, you know, a substantial sum of money.
So how will those get clarified? Well, so I guess in terms of the amounts to be awarded, that's got to go back to the tribunal. But these other things like the VAT or the apprenticeship levy or those other kind of costs, I guess the relevant government departments will take a view on that and pursue Uber directly. I don't know how it works. I feel like I should know how it works, but I don't.
No, that's okay. I mean, it's really quite interesting because, you know, we're still not through our pandemic. You know, the Treasury has spent untold billions on trying to keep the economy going. And, you know, we'll all face the bill for many years. So there will be pressure on HMRC and Treasury to recoup money wherever they possibly can.
I've no idea what Uber's turnover would be, but whatever it is, it's going to be into the millions, I would guess. So if you start factoring in VAT on that, that's 20%. It could add up. Anyway, we digress. So let's come back to the employment law side of things.
Aside from all of those cost, Julia. There's a few other things going on. Interestingly, Uber are also facing a separate action by four drivers in the Netherlands about the algorithm that it uses to rate. I mentioned the ratings before, to rate and ultimately potentially to dismiss drivers. Now, the reason it's being filed in the Netherlands is because Uber is actually a Dutch company, albeit in all of the jurisdictions it operates in, there will be a local subsidiary or what they call affiliate, but it's actually headquartered in the Netherlands. And so that's why they've taken the case there. Although three of the four are actually from the UK and the fourth driver is from Portugal. And potentially they're going to look at the breach of Article 22 of the General Data Protection Regulations, the GDPR, which we loved many a number of years ago. So it's a potential, quite a different claim. And in just on that point, there is actually a proposal for an EU directive on digital platform workers. And there is a specific provision in there looking at algorithms and how they operate. Now, this is at very, very early stages. It's proposed by a French MEP. I don't quite know where it is at the moment. But I, you know, I certainly wouldn't expect anything before the end of this year or maybe even next year. It does mean that finally, you know, this is being discussed, but there is a specific provision in there about these algorithms. And we heard a lot about algorithms last year, didn't we, with students about how they were rated, etc. And it's all about the transparency. It's about not understanding how these algorithms work, but also what human input is there, or is it purely, are these decisions made purely, you know, based on AI and an algorithm? So, yeah, so that would be quite an interesting case. So I suppose if I were to put words in your mouth, your question would be, well, will this destroy Uber? Can Uber exist? I've mentioned, you know, the various costs that it could potentially face. That would certainly be very costly. But it is a global company and it does have a massive economic power. And I've already mentioned that as consumers, we probably can expect to pay more. I would expect Uber to probably try to amend its terms with the drivers and passengers. But we've already identified that this court said you don't just look at the terms, you look at the reality as well. So that's a question of really just how much does Uber want to change its business model, if at all, in order to be able to avoid saying that these individuals are workers. So that's a different discussion. And that's one that will happen internally in Uber, but possibly also in other platforms as well, depending on how they operate.
Yeah, and it's quite interesting, the potential impact on the workers themselves. So as we've said a few times, this judgment only applies to those workers kind of within this judgment. But I did wonder whether Uber would start to give its drivers a choice about how they're engaged. So because I know from the very little research I've done, some Uber drivers are very, very happy being self-employed and they like being able to work as and when and all of that. Some less so because they feel that they do want to accrue holiday, etc. So I just wonder whether Uber might say, okay, Fred, you want to be self-employed, this is the terms with you and your pay is structured in this way, and Susan, you want to be a worker, this is your pay and structure. And I don't know, I'm sure one of the other platforms does that, maybe one of the courier delivery ones, I'm not 100% certain. But anyway, what do you think will be the impact on the workers themselves?
Well, actually, you raise a really important point there. And certainly, you know, there isn't, you know, it isn't universally, this decision hasn't been universally welcomed by drivers. Clearly, there are a group of drivers who do quite welcome it. But there are also some who are saying, well, no, I still want to be classified as self-employed and I will consider myself as self-employed. But just in terms of how companies might react to this, it's interesting because when I was talking to the Uber driver this week, you know, for research purposes, and he did mention a courier company that he had previously worked for and how they had given him an alternative to working per trip or per hour, albeit I was quite alarmed at how low the hourly wage was. It was above minimum wage. But for example, he told me that he'd been asked to drive from London to Newcastle, but he was only paid X amount, which, you know, I think the round trip was 6 to 7 hours a month, possibly longer than that. But he couldn't really pick up any journeys on the way back. So actually, he earned very little out of that particular journey. Now, that might be one of the longest journeys he did, but it's one of those examples where being paid per hour wasn't particularly helpful either. But, it's certainly alternatives will be offered. And in terms of the research I was doing for this, I found an article about an agreement in Italy. So, you know, Uber operates, as I said, globally. There have been different reactions to it across Europe. But in Italy recently, Uber, along with some other food delivery platforms, have actually signed an agreement with a trade union, agreeing to certain provisions and protections for workers, including, a minimum of 10 euros per hour, a bonus for working at night and in bad weather, access to safety equipment and insurance. And the platforms that have signed these have pledged to keep the ranking systems transparent. So those are the ratings we were talking about earlier, and not punish couriers for not accepting jobs. But this agreement has actually come in for some criticism because it's quite a small union, which apparently has agreed this. There are many other larger unions which haven't agreed this yet. And it has also been affiliated to a far right group. And so actually one commentator has even said that this is going to be the first collective agreement that deprives workers of rights. So quite an interesting reaction to that. But in terms of things to watch for, Uber is actually banned in some countries. So it's banned at the moment in Denmark and Germany, so it can't even operate there.
Okay.
They have lost some cases in France and Spain and elsewhere. I've just mentioned Italy. I've also mentioned the proposed digital platform, the directive on digital platform workers, which specifically refers to service companies operating in the licensed driver, passenger transport and meal delivery sector. So here we're talking Uber, Uber Eats, Deliveroo, etc.
Yeah.
As I said, very early stages, not quite sure where it is at the moment. But of course, even if it is adopted by the EU, well, we've now left the EU. Now, that brings me on to where we are in the UK. You and I, again, over the years, we've been talking a lot about worker rights, but also we specifically were working on Matthew Taylor, the consultations on the Matthew Taylor report. So he was appointed by Theresa May back in, was it 2016, 2017?
Something like that.
It's a long time ago now, to look at worker rights. And he produced his report in 2018. He had 53 recommendations. The government accepted 51 of them. It's implemented a very small number, but there are, but we are waiting for a lot more, not least regulation around umbrella companies, etc. But, there were a lot of things in there about potentially aligning tax and employment status. But he also did specifically want a review into gig economy worker rights, etc.
Yes. Yeah. But
that hasn't happened yet. And then also post-Brexit, the government announced a review of existing employment legislation, but then they withdrew that very quickly. So there's a bit of a muddle going on about where we are. We've been awaiting a new employment bill, but between Brexit and the pandemic, it just hasn't happened. But people are really pushing government on this because there's a lot of really good and important stuff in that report, which should have been legislated for in the employment bill. Quite a lot going on there. But of course, you can expect these businesses to fight back. You know, they're not going to take this lying down.
Absolutely.
Exactly. And just a couple of days before the Supreme Court judgment, actually, Uber published a white paper called A Better Deal for European Platform Workers. It has come in naturally for quite a lot of criticism. they've also been pushing for regulation which suits them elsewhere. So, for example, in California, they spent a staggering $200 million fighting what was called Proposition 22, which would have reclassified drivers as employees. This went for a public vote and Uber won. So actually the drivers were not classified as workers. So they're definitely fighting back, and we can, you know, watch this space. We can see a clash coming, I think, in terms of what union workers want versus what all of these platforms are going to want. But legislation is always way behind technology. and by many, many years.
Yes.
You know, it's certainly going to be fertile ground, I think, for employment lawyers, but also just very interesting, I think, from a social as well as a legal point of view.
Brilliant. Well, on that note, thank you so much for sharing your expertise and for kind of doing so much research around the subject for us. Really, really appreciate that. And it's been enlightening. And I, as I say, it's always when I talk to you about these things, I think I know a bit about it, but actually it turns out the detail I'm less good on. So brilliant. Thank you so much for joining us.
Well, no, you're very welcome. I enjoy coming on.
Thank you for listening to All About Self-Employment, hosted by Julia Kermode. For more information on today's discussion, please visit iwork.co.uk, where you can also join our growing community. We hope you enjoyed today's episode, and if you did, then we would love you to subscribe, rate, and review our podcast. We'll be back at the same time next week.